Andrew, Granny says that I once promised you that I would tell you some of my experiences during the First World War. I don't quite know where to begin, but I suppose I'd better tell you from when I left school and worked for a little while until I was old enough to join the army. I wanted to join the South African Scottish, which was then in France with the 1st Brigade, because my brother Willie was in that regiment. However, the East African campaign was then underway, and they wanted recruits for the 8 infantry battalions there, so I was not allowed to go overseas and join the South African Scottish. So I joined up with the 11th South African Infantry, sometimes known as the Flying 11th. We were a part of the 3rd Brigade, which consisted of the 9th, 10th, 11th and 12th Infantry. I must tell you a little story about the 9th Infantry. When they were recruiting for this regiment, some stupid fool who had a lot to say said that we are now recruiting men for the Sportsman's Battalion, and we only want the cream of South Africa in this battalion. So it wasn't surprising that afterwards this 9th Battalion was always referred to as the Creamy 9th. Well, that didn't worry me because I was in the 11th. After campaigning for some time in Kenya and Tanganyika, which is now known as Tanzania, I was invalided home suffering from malaria. After recovering for a little while at home, I rejoined the forces, this time in the South African Scottish for overseas. Unfortunately, I never saw my brother Willie because he was killed in France while I was training in England. That was a very sad blow for me, but one just had to put up with these things in those days. I hadn't been very long in the trenches in France when the Germans started their great final offensive in 1918. Our brigade was overwhelmed and practically annihilated, and only those who were wounded in the early stages of the four-day battle, or those who were blotted out on the last desperate day. No, I'm quite wrong in saying that. Well, I should have said that only those who were not taken, not wounded or killed, were taken prisoner by the Germans on that last desperate day. I was one of the lucky ones and ended up in Germany. To get there, we had marched for a long way through Belgium, then had a long train ride in a cattle truck into Germany, finally arriving at our destination somewhere in Westphalen. We call it Westphalia. After we had been marshaled into our separate categories and had gone through a delousing plant where our good uniforms were taken away from us and we were issued with ersatz uniforms, or clothing rather, made in Germany from what looked and felt like newspapers, we were put to work down the mine. I worked underground with a miner, a coal miner, And while there, we had some very funny experiences. I joined forces with another South African by the name of Jimmy Wilson, and together we planned to make a bid to get out of this. We planned to make our attempt on a Sunday, shortly after having received a consignment of stuff from England. The Red Cross in Britain sent food parcels and comforts regularly to the British troops in Germany. When we got our consignment parcel, we decided to make our attempt the following Sunday, because Sunday was a rest day and we were free to move around inside the wire enclosure as we liked. There was a roll call at 3 o'clock, no, not 3 o'clock, 6 o'clock in the afternoon, and after that there was another break until the final roll call at 9 o'clock, after which we were hustled into the wooden huts, barracks, and locked up for the night. The camp was a lot of big wooden huts surrounded by high barbed wire fences with searchlights trained all the way along. But there was one little place where there was a slight bit of shadow thrown on a small section of the wire by a couple of buildings that were quite close together. This shadowy place we made our target. And during this 3 hours, we made frequent trips down to the latrines or to the wash house to wash a dish or something, and there was always one of us going backwards and forwards, as other men were. Now, Wilson had managed to hide a pair of pliers from his Lewis gun team. How he had done that, I don't quite know. Sometimes he said he stood on them, sometimes he said he dropped them from his right hand to his left hand as he was being searched, but he got away with it. So on these frequent trips down to the wash house, we cut one wire in the fence. The next one then took a turn and he went down to wash a cup or something and he cut a wire. Watching carefully to see if he was unobserved by the sentries, it was still light at that time. When the final wire had been cut, it was approaching 9 o'clock, dark, or getting dark. The searchlights had been switched on and we all fell in for our final roll call. We felt rather conspicuous because we had stuffed a lot of the food we'd got from England in the way of biscuits and dried bread and that sort of thing in the linings of our tunics. But we were not noticed by the guard. These tunics were part of the uniform sent to us from Britain and they consisted of a dark serge material with broad brown stripes down the sleeves and the legs of the trousers so that they could readily be identified as prisoners. So when the 9 o'clock Wekkertrekken or dismiss was given, everybody rushed down to the wash house and the latrines for a final visit to the latrines. As everybody could not get in at the same time in the limited time, some of the fellows lined up against the fence. Some of them, our friends amongst them, completely obscuring the hole we had cut in the fence. So we ducked down with them and
scrambled between their legs and through this little hole, getting a little splashed in the process, but this was a small consequence. We crawled quietly away for about 25 yards and rose to our feet to get a little bit of faster going behind a bit of a wall, when I kicked an empty tin which made a racket fit to waken the dead. We fell flat on our faces and waited breathlessly for some reaction from the guards, but there was nothing, because at that moment there was quite a lot of shouting as the fellows were going back into the bungalows to be locked up. So apparently the little noise I had made had been drowned by the greater noise in the camp. After some time we moved off again, this time very much more silently, until we were sure we were well out of earshot of the barracks and amongst the mine buildings near the pit head. This we negotiated quite safely because we knew the layout of the mine, and we started off guided by our little compass in a northwesterly direction. The pole star was over a little bit to the right, so we knew just how well we were being guided by these twin guides.
Tell them about the map and how you were.
We had managed to wangle a small map from the jerry underground with whom we were working in exchange for some of our cigarettes, which had come from a previous consignment from Britain. We managed to get a compass and a miniature torch, which was a very small affair, at the size of a lead pencil, but good enough to show us the compass needle. We made good progress until we came to the first hazard, a town, I think it was called Recklinghausen, but I'm not sure now. And we had to pass through the outskirts because there was a railway line which we knew was heavily guarded on the right and a river on the left. We got through this after having greeted a few pedestrians in the streets, got in first with our good night and breathed quite a sigh of relief when we were past that first hazard. We pushed on steadily until the sky started to get light in the east, and we knew that it wouldn't be very long before it was light. So we now had to look out for a place to hide up in the daytime. We chose what looked like a thick clump of wood and settled down to wait the daylight hours to pass. But when it grew light, we were very disappointed to find that what we had taken to be a thick wood was just a little copse, and we could see through it in all directions and saw that it was just a little hillock left in the middle of a field. What made it worse was some school children passed very close to us, and we felt sure that they had seen us, and we waited for the alarm to go up, but there was no movement. Though a man came out with a plough and ploughed in the field not 200 yards away from us. We spent an anxious day and were very thankful when night fell and we were able to get out of this exposed position. So we trudged on. I think our next hazard was to cross the River Lippa, which is a wide river running across our path. I think it is a tributary of the Rhine, but I'm not sure of that. We felt that the best place to cross would be where it joined a canal, the Dortmund-Ems Canal, as we felt sure there would be a bridge there. Well, our navigation and map reading was excellent, or perhaps just lucky, because we struck the canal about 400 yards from the bridge, which we could see against the sky. We lay for a long time before daring to cross, and then decided that we'd better cross noisily so as not to arouse suspicion, as a stealthy walkover might do. So we left our boots on and clattered across the bridge, absolutely nothing. Lucky again, we passed that hazard and went on until dawn began to appear in the east again. This time we settled for a deeper wood in which to spend the day, but were dismayed to find in the early morning that it was the scene of a deer hunt. And though we heard shots, sometimes very close to us, and once a frightened deer dashed past, we saw no hunters, and what was better, no hunters saw us. So we continued on for a few days like this, until finally it started to rain. And it rained and rained, and there was no sky, no stars. Our little torch had given up. We couldn't see the compass, and we had no idea in which direction to go. I wanted to go one way, Wilson wanted to go the opposite way, and we didn't know what to do. Eventually we saw a light and approached very cautiously and found that it came from a low window, and peering in we saw there was a woman sewing. We watched her for a long time, and nobody came in to talk to her. This was, of course, was very late at night. It must have been nearly around about midnight. So in the end, we plucked up courage and went and tapped on her window, and she said, "Best up," or something like that. And Wilson, who considered himself a better linguist than I was, said, "Schwein on for Lure." And then he said in his best German, "We seek the road to Stadtlohn." I distinctly remember her pointing out of the window to a faint glow in the sky and saying, "Der Luft in der Himmel ist Stadtlohn." Well, now we knew where we were. So we thanked her and backed hurriedly away before she could raise any alarms. We thought we would clear Stadtlohn quite easily, but it turned out to be a much bigger town than we had reckoned on, and we got involved in the outskirts and walked right into a sentry. He was standing guarding a big iron gate. Don't know what was behind the gate, but it must have been an important place to mount a guard all through the night. Well, he may have been a bit sleepy, because we got in first and said, "Good night." And he very sleepily and politely answered, "Good night," and that seemed to wake him up, because he said, "Wait, wait, wait." But Wilson made some laughing rejoinder in German, something to the effect of, "Why don't you wake up?" By the time this sentry had collected himself, his wits rather, we were out of sight and out of earshot. Another sigh of relief and we were on our way again. But when it rained so badly that we couldn't see more than 3 or 4 yards in front of us, and we felt that we were getting very near the border, we decided to stop where we were for the remainder of the night and to move off in the daylight where we could see our way and could see danger ahead. The country was now very wooded, which gave us additional confidence and protection. We hadn't gone very far that morning when I heard a thump as of somebody kicking something wooden. I put my hand back to stop Wilson, who was just following me, and crept very quietly forward on my hands and knees. And then looking through the undergrowth of a pine tree, I saw a German sentry standing in a sentry box with his legs crossed. He must have kicked the floor of the box as he changed position. He was reading the newspaper, and Wilson, who had now joined me, ever the wag, whispered in my ear, "Bald Frieden," which means soon be peace. We backed very silently and quietly away from that sentry, went about 100 yards further back into the forest, turned right, moved another 200 yards approximately in that direction, turned left again, and advanced cautiously until we came to the road. It was a wide road and looked an important road. And looking to our right, we saw another sentry in a box, about 200 or 300 yards to the right. And we could see our newspaper reading friend to the left. So obviously it was useless to go further because it looked as if there were sentries all the way along. So we decided to make a dash for it. And that we did. We dashed across the road and then we heard shouting and shots. We don't know whether they were fired in our direction or anything more about it because we were soon lost in the thick wood. And we continued on for a long time until we came to a small stream, might have been a canal, but it looked pretty deep. And there were some big stones in the middle of it, and I thought they might be used as stepping stones. There was also a thin tree trunk lying across from bank to bank of this little river or stream. Wilson thought that jumping over the stones was a bit risky, and he chose to cross by the frail bridge. I thought the bridge looked very slippery and very narrow, so I chose the stones. And I had just successfully made the final leap onto the other bank when I heard a loud splash and Wilson had fallen in. I don't know why I thought this was so funny, but it really appealed to me as something worth laughing at. And though Jimmy Wilson for once lost his sense of humor and couldn't see anything funny in it at all. We continued through this wood for some time still and eventually came to the edge of the wood and saw in front of us a large field in the middle of which a woman was hoeing. She was accompanied by a huge black dog. We didn't like the look of the dog, but we decided the only thing to do was to go up to her and ask if we were in Holland or Germany. So we went up as quietly as we could without trying to arouse the dog, which was eyeing us very hungrily. We got about 10 yards from the woman and said, "Good afternoon. Are we in Holland or Germany?" And when she said Holland, she got the shock of her life because, ignoring the snarl of the dog, we rushed up to her and threw our arms around her neck, hugged her and waltzed around. Ignoring the snapping of her big dog, when she had quieted the dog, she pointed out the direction we must take to get to the town of Winterswijk, which was the town that we had been aiming for all the time. When we got there, some of the people, farmers I suppose, gave us some food. A big bowl of very fatty soupy stew and some cheese, bread, and a cup of coffee. Cheese and bread and a coffee were excellent, but I didn't like the fatty stew. Now Wilson didn't mind because he polished off my portion in double quick time. We were then put into a room for the night. And this room apparently had been used by some Frenchmen because a lot of the walls were written with French names and battalions and places, addresses and that. Couldn't see any other South African names, so Wilson, who was a bit of an artist, drew an elaborate sketch of two men walking, and underneath which he put our names, regimental numbers and that, all our histories. Next day, we were given train tickets to go to a place called Didam, D-I-D-A-M, where we were put in quarantine. Apparently the purpose of this quarantine was to see that we didn't bring any infectious diseases into neutral Holland from war-torn Germany. After we had finished our period of quarantine, I don't know how long it was, perhaps 10 days, we were put on a train and sent to Rotterdam to report to the British consul, when we were given a sort of passport. I've still got mine, as a matter of fact. And when we arrived in Holland, we learned that the armistice had been signed. This is the 11th of November, 1918, and the end of the First World War. The consul was a very harassed man. He gave us an orderly to look after us, who gave us uniforms and one guilder each. A guilder in that time was worth 1 4 pence of English money. Well, I forget what we spent our guilder on, but I know we had something to eat. Though we had been well fed in Didam, we slept that night in a park because we had been told we had to find our own way to England, because though Holland was neutral and quiet, Germany wasn't quiet, because all the prisons had been thrown open. And though the internees, prisoners of war and criminals, were all let loose, and they were rushing across the border of Holland where there was food. Amongst these internees were a lot of British Marines who had been captured in the Belgian fort of Namur in 1914, and they had been sent into Holland at the expense of the British government, and they had been interned there for 4 years, and every year they got 3 weeks blighty leave. Blighty, you might remember, is what the troops called England. Well, their camp in Holland was a very fine thing. It was like a permanent British camp. It had concert halls and parade grounds and goodness knows what, all the amenities. So they had a very good time. We found our way down to the docks and tried to get on a little steamer which we knew was crossing for England, and were thrown off because it had been reserved for the Marines by order of the British government. And though we pleaded our case, they said, out, off, rough, and so we had to clean it off. But when dark came, we sneaked on board, clambered over a couple of moored shallow boats or dinghies on the side, and managed to climb up some rigging onto this little boat and hid behind the boat. And we weren't detected until the thing was halfway to England. We arrived in Hull that next morning to find the city laid out with red carpets, bands, and civic functions to welcome the Marines. I don't hold this against the Marines because it wasn't their fault they'd been captured so early in the war. But it was a bit disappointing for us to find that we were nothing. Nobody wanted to speak to us. Couldn't get a soul to talk to us or anything. Take the slightest notice of us. Eventually we did get train tickets to a place called Ripon in Yorkshire, where there was a military camp. They called it a transit camp. Well, we spent a couple of days at Ripon, got into lots of hot water because I saluted an officer with my left hand and was picked out by a red cap, and I gave him a bit of cheek. He got very nasty about it. The reason I saluted the left hand was because that's the way we were trained, to salute with the hand furthest from the officer. That, while we were in Germany, that had been dropped, and all saluting was done with the right hand only. However, that was a minor thing. From Ripon we were sent down to the south to join our units, and I went to Woking in Surrey, where the South Africans had been when I left. Couldn't find anybody there but an old quartermaster named Jimmy Spearman, and he gave me a kilt, for which I was very grateful. Then we got tickets and went to Luggershaw in Wiltshire, where the South Africans were now grouping preparatory to being sent home. The trouble about being sent home was that they were sending the married men first. And not being married, we were not considered. Then, to make matters worse, they put us on the parade ground to march up and down, doing left, right by numbers, with the boys who had just arrived in England as reinforcements to the brigade. Of course, this was very galling for us because we this time felt that we were not rookies anymore. And all the old hands went on strike. It wasn't actually a mutiny, and now things were a bit relaxed after the war. It wasn't so sticky as it had been if it had happened a fortnight earlier before the armistice had been signed. We'd have been shot probably. Anyway, the Australians, who had a camp at Tidworth, a town quite nearby, they came out in sympathy and added their weight to our little strike. The result was they let us off the parades. So we did nothing more until we managed to get transport, and we entrained for Liverpool, where we caught a ship for South Africa. When I arrived in Cape Town, I was walking along Adderley Street and I met a fellow who had been with me in East Africa. And he is overjoyed to see me because he'd heard that I'd been killed. And when we talked about it, he realized that it was my brother. Anyway, he was so pleased to see me. He said, "Before we go and see my wife, I've told her all about you. You must come and have a drink." And I didn't know anything about drinking. Anyway, I went into the pub with him, and we didn't get to see his wife that night because by the time we said goodnight, it was too late. It was 9 o'clock. And I met him the next day, and the next day, and the next, and we never got to see his wife, because he had made a lot of money in East Africa, and he had a lot of friends in Cape Town, and these friends were helping him to spend the money that he had earned in East Africa. It's funny the way he earned this money. apparently because he was a big shot from the docks at Cape Town, I think he was a dock superintendent, he was left behind our regiment in East Africa to look after a huge native territory. I don't know what his actual function was, but he's a sort of commissioner, something of that nature. And he said they had thousands of army unit tents and that sort of thing, blankets. They didn't know what to do with them. They were, the army, the war had passed. It was hundreds of miles to the south. And there was no transport, and everything was, they were absolutely marooned there. He says, and they started to cut the tents up and sell them to the natives. And they came out of that place somewhere near Moragora, I think, with valises full of money. I knew that because I had helped him to spend some of that money in Durban in 1917, I think it was, 1916, when I came back from East Africa. Anyway, to cut a long story short, Sid Buckley, that was his name, and all his friends were making sure that this ill-gotten money was quickly dissipated, and this was a couple of years later, and they still had some left. Anyway, eventually I left Cape Town, sent on a train to go home to my parents in Dundee. Dundee, you may remember, is a branch line, and the junction is at Glencoe Junction. My mother, my brother Alistair, and I think my little sister Lottie had come to meet me there. And they were overjoyed to see me, and I was glad to see them, of course. Then my mother introduced me to Miss Garstang, who had come to see her brother through on his way to Newcastle, and asked me if I'd seen Captain Garstang. I said, no, I haven't seen Captain Garstang. I don't have any officers. Anyway, when we went back to Dundee in the train, Miss Garstang came with us, because she knew my mother, and she'd been at the training college with my sister. And my mother put on a little party to welcome me home, and Miss Garstang was there. And I looked at her very hard, and I thought, very nice, but not for me. Anyway, she had many other admirers, and they had a big advantage over me because they were all tall, dark, and handsome. Now, I was very handsome and quite dark, but even my best friends had never said I was tall. So, as I was working under a disability, I had to use the old nut. And I noticed that when all these chaps told of their valiant deeds in the army, that Miss Garstang just looked down her nose. So, but no, she doesn't like braggarts, so I must be very quiet, mustn't shout about all my heroic deeds in the army, I must say them down. Actually, I had no heroic deeds to talk about anyway. And she's theatre-like soccer, and I like soccer too. When I knew she was watching soccer, I just about swallowed the ball to anything. So that, you see, by a little bit of using the old skull, I carried off the prize. Took me a long time though, for the hard work, because she was hard to get, and she wasn't playing hard to get, she was hard to get. But once she saw what a nice chap I was, she couldn't say no anymore. So after, I think, we were engaged for about 2 years before we got married. I told her that she would have a hard life if she married me because I was poor. I didn't have much in the way of qualifications. All I knew was that I liked her very much and I was willing to work for her. One thing I didn't tell her, I think she's just found it out now. I didn't tell her that if she married me, she'd be stuck with me for 50 years. Well, Andrew, I'm not going to say any more about the war. I'll leave you to fill in the bits yourself. I worry. Andrew, Granny said I haven't told you any of the more interesting side of my life in the army. First of all, I think I would like to tell you about my half section in the 11th Infantry in East Africa. He was a fellow called Donald Mackay. He went to school with me. He was in the same class actually, and he was known as Porky because he was very stout. But he was such a good-natured fellow that he couldn't play football for laughing. So he was written off as no sportsman whatsoever. Every time somebody took the ball from him, he treated it as a huge joke and went into gales of laughter. Proper softy, we thought. Well, it happened that he and I joined the 11th SAI on the same day and went up to the training camp. It was, Potchefstroom, a very cold place. And the first morning we got there, he would slip down to the showers, and there he stood under an icy cold shower. He was so white because he didn't swim with the rest of the boys. He was like as if he'd been powdered with French chalk. But he had a grin on his face from ear to ear. He seemed to relish the cold water. He wasn't much of a shot, and he always lagged behind on the route marches and seemed to be a dead loss as a soldier because he just could not get serious about the training. When we got to East Africa, I found that he was a great scrounger. We were getting very little food. At the time, we got one small breakfast cup of flour each a day. No salt, no sugar, nothing else. Occasionally we got a piece of meat. We got an ox slaughtered and it was divided amongst the whole battalion, and our section of it got a hindquarter. Supposed to do 250 men, but they were such small little ox, they looked like sheep, so that we were always pretty hungry. But Donald Mackay managed to find food somewhere. He would go scouting all over the place, where every time we stopped, come back with a few odd mealies or some nuts or something he had scrounged. Then the first time we went into action, I suppose I should call it action, because we were marching along the road and the order came, get off the road, decorate your helmets and disappear into the bush and advance towards that kopje. It's being held by German askaris and you are to fire at any askari on sight. Keep yourselves well hidden. We don't want any casualties if we can help it. Well, we were advancing through the bush, firing an occasional shot of in the direction in which we thought the enemy were, if we caught a glimpse of anything moving. And suddenly I heard, "There they are! I can see them! I can see them!" And I looked up, and Donald Mackay had climbed up on top of a tall rock. It was about 10 feet high, and he got up the top of it, and he was standing up there with, "I can see them! There they are! I can see them!" And I said, "Get off that rock, you fool, you want to get shot." And the bullets were ricocheting off this rock in which he was perched. He had a gun in his hand, but he wasn't shooting. He was pointing it where he could see the askaris on the other side. Didn't seem to matter to him that he was being shot at. But eventually he was ordered down off his rock, and the march proceeded. I didn't actually shoot it at anything, though I did see a few fleeting movements in the bush and fired in that direction, but I don't think I got within 10 yards of any askari.